At least two major scientific publications have spoken up against President Trump. Is this the end of nonpartisan science, or was there no such thing in the first place?
This is an emergency. This is the biggest public health crisis we've faced in this country. It's hard to not act when you see something like this.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, October 13th, the politicization of science now and in the future. Also on the show, as Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings continue, the renewed push by some Democrats to reform the court in big ways. Plus, the first full-time curator of Native American art for the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York considers how to present Native art to viewers today.
So there's this really wonderful conversation that happens when we exhibit historical and contemporary Native art together.
Okay, here we go. Since President Trump took office, he and his administration have consistently refuted and acted contrary to the advice of scientists on everything from the COVID-19 pandemic to natural disasters, which have been made worse by climate change. Here's the president speaking recently about the wildfires in California, which was the worst fire season to date.
It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch.
I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually. Tom?
Science does know about the dangers of climate change and the coronavirus, too. But the president's disregard for experts has never been more clear than during the pandemic.
I went through it. Now they say I'm immune. I feel so powerful. I'll walk into that audience. I'll walk in there. I'll kiss everyone in that audience. Lock yourself in a basement and say, I'm not going to bother with the world. You got to get out, and it's risky. It's risky, but you got to get out.
Traditionally, scientists have stayed above the partisan fray, but scientists today are speaking out in unprecedented ways to warn what another 4 years under the Trump administration could cost the country. For the first time in its 208-year run, the New England Journal of Medicine published an editorial denouncing the Trump administration and its lack of scientific-based actions in their response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Quote, the response of our nation's leaders has been consistently inadequate, the editorial noted. Similarly, for the first time in its 175-year history, Scientific American backed a presidential candidate, endorsing Joe Biden and condemning President Trump's response to the pandemic, writing, quote, the evidence and the science show that Donald Trump has badly damaged the U.S. and its people because he rejects evidence and science.
I'm somebody that gets it, and nobody really knows. It's not something that's so hard and fast.
For more on this, I'm joined now by Dr. Eric J. Rubin, the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Rubin, thanks for being with me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Valerie Aquino is a co-founder of the National March for Science and a human and environment researcher at the University of New Mexico. Valerie, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Tanzina. Thank you for inviting me to join this conversation.
Dr. Rubin, let's start with you. Why did the New England Journal of Medicine decide to speak out at this moment against the Trump administration?
Well, it was really an accumulation of lots of things. There were many simple things that our country should have instituted, and we just failed to do them. And over time, it became clear that we as scientists and clinicians could offer the best advice we could, but it just wasn't being acted upon. In the end, we just decided that the only thing we could do is have a change in our leaders rather than more advice.
Were there specific things, Dr. Rubin, that the Trump administration has done during the pandemic that pushed you and the other editors to make this call?
I think it was more what they failed to do. We know what works. We know that there are public health measures that can be instituted that really help in controlling the spread of disease. And yet none of them were applied consistently at all.
And what you're talking about specifically are things like wearing masks?
That's right. Wearing masks, social distancing, contact tracing, testing, isolation and quarantine. All of these things were practiced haphazardly throughout the country. And that was the fault of many leaders, but to a great extent, the federal government has an important role in that, and they just didn't step up.
Dr. Rubin, has an academic or science journal ever waded into electoral politics like this?
Well, I can't speak for all journals. I think there are some that are a bit more political than we are. But for ours, no. And I think that's been true for many of the major journals. You mentioned Scientific American. I'd add Science and The Lancet and Nature to that as well.
And have you had any responses to the editorial so far, Dr. Rubin?
Oh, yes, we have. Largely, they've been positive. But I think there's a smattering of concerns about whether or not we're the right ones to be opining on such things.
And what are your thoughts on that?
This is an emergency. This is the biggest public health crisis we faced in this country, and in fact, worldwide. And it's hard to not act when you see something like this. In fact, that's our job. Our job is to communicate the information that can help the health in general and the public health overall, and to not comment on the most important thing going on at the time would be a dereliction of duty.
Valerie, this is not a new conversation, at least as far as scientists are concerned, under the Trump administration. You have been active at the intersection of science and politics since very early in the Trump presidency. I recall around the time that the Women's March was being put together, there was also a March for Science in 2017. What was the goal then?
That's right. Actually, the Women's March had inspired me personally to get involved as a national co-chair for the inaugural March for Science, which was held on Earth Day in 2017. And that had galvanized over a million people worldwide in more than 600 cities in dozens of countries around the world to demonstrate for science because of what people and various communities throughout our international community were seeing in their spaces. And to me, it's clear that what's going on isn't exclusively restricted to the U.S. alone. So while it might be personally gainful or maybe politically convenient to levy anti-science accusations against one or another political party, evidence does show this phenomenon was shared and is shared in situations around the world. And one of the things that concern me is how this collective international outcry for political leaders to listen to science, to education, to health experts, it shares space with a rise in authoritarian governments or authoritarian-leaning decision makers, and how we really need to work together as a global community to combat the erosion of critical thinking and to defend hard-won democratic processes.
So you're concerned specifically, I'm thinking about countries like Brazil, perhaps, in the UK?
Yes, and also India, the Philippines, Mexico. They've had a lot of March for Science galvanized presence and organizing over the past 3 years specifically.
Valerie, are you seeing more scientists speaking out publicly about politics now than you have prior to this administration?
Absolutely. I see a substantive change. You know, looking at the past 3 years, we've all seen a constant parade of evidence demonstrating this administration's consistent undermining of established best practices, of silencing top climate policy and health experts in the federal government, removing publicly funded climate science data off of publicly funded government websites, and reassigning experts in their fields to positions that hold little meaning for them, to most recently, of course, the president flaunting total disregard for public health safety measures during his own COVID diagnosis. But in that same time, as you've mentioned, and as Dr. Eric Rubin have discussed, we've also seen these remarkable and unprecedented spontaneous and organized responses, including the Scientific American and New England Journal of Medicine editorials. And, you know, as mentioned, they've never done that in their history. So, one, thank you so much, Dr. Rubin. And I also think that in large part, it's similar. It's not unlike what a lot of March for Science participants had said after their inaugural involvement. These have been truly historic times. And I think that they're in large part due to this administration's embracing and spreading of deliberate misinformation and its rejection and outright removals of trained experts from again, hard-earned positions. You know, it's almost as if they're taking science and the integrity of the people working for it hostage.
How do we explain that Valerie? I mean, you've sort of talked a little bit about how this is tends to be a hallmark of authoritarian governments, but how else do we explain that? And Dr. Rubin, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that too. Like, why, what does the Trump administration have to gain by undermining scientists?
Well, I think that there are other factors at play. The Trump administration considers any attack on their economic policy to be undermining them, and they feel that the costs of many scientifically driven agendas are going to be excessive. And I think that would be a reasonable conversation, except that there is real science with which to judge that. And I think, let me give an example. In Sweden, they made the decision to cut back on their public health measures and increase the rate of transmission to try to get more immune protection in the population. Denmark, right next door, decided not to do that. Both of those countries made reasoned decisions. They looked at the science and said, we could do this or we could do that, and there's no right answer, and they chose different paths. But in the U.S., we just didn't look at the science at all. We didn't have a plan. Instead, we decided to open, driven by economic reasons, without thinking about the consequences of that. And I think we can see the short-term problems with doing something like that in the case of an epidemic. In the case of climate change, which Valerie's discussing, it's a much longer-term problem. But again, there are trade-offs that we're not considering here.
And Valerie, in your conversations with other scientists, has the urgency increased over the course of the past 3 years, as you mentioned, since the March for Science?
Yes, I feel that and I've heard that people feel compelled to get out of their typical kind of comfort zones and to be more vocal and to be more active and civically engaged in their educational and professional and civic responsibilities. The extreme partisanship in how science has been politicized and skewed to almost something unrecognizable under this administration has been lethal political theater, and it's being performed at the expense of people's lives and futures. But this isn't entertainment TV. This is real life involving real people that have to make decisions without the benefit of reliable scientific leadership and accurate guidance.
Dr. Rubin, it's not just journals. It's also other prominent scientists telling us about this moment. What's different about this moment in particular? Have you ever seen in your career a federal administration this antagonistic to the scientific community?
I don't think I have. And it was something that always was concerning throughout this administration. But the consequences are so vast right now. We're talking about tens of thousands of excess lives being lost because of the moves of the administration. And remember, they have access to the best scientific information out there. Not only do they have the availability of journals like ours and many others that are illustrating what's going on scientifically, but they have really outstanding scientists within the government. And they have chosen to sideline them, in some cases cutting budgets, in other cases overcoming their scientifically made decisions with political ones. And it is really incredible the scale of what's going on at this point.
I'm wondering, Dr. Rubin, also, when we've interviewed medical professionals on this show about specifically about how they're grappling with the pressures of the coronavirus in different cities across the country where they're seeing spikes in the virus and obviously emergency rooms overflowing. We here in New York witnessed that firsthand. Dr. Rubin, when you talk to other medical professionals, are they concerned? These are folks that, you know, are not generally in the political fray. But during this virus, we've seen doctors and nurses have to come out and in some cases physically put themselves as a barrier between protests and hospitals. In other cases, asking for personal protective equipment that they don't have. In other cases, these are the folks who are dealing with the people who are getting sick by not following the CDC guidelines. So what are the medical professionals telling you?
Well, I certainly was on the wards during the peak in Boston, which was not quite as bad as it was in New York, but really was very substantial. And I think that there's been a tremendous level of frustration rising to the point of anger over exactly what you're discussing. After all, people have been putting themselves on the line and they see there aren't enough masks. In fact, we got an alert from the hospital today about restrictions on personal protective equipment, PPE, because there really still is not a full availability of these things. And to take chances to put yourself out there and not have even simple measures available to protect oneself is frustrating and as I said, angering.
Valerie, what about funding for science and under this administration? Have you noticed a decrease in the prioritization of scientific research or funding for scientific research? And I'm asking this question with the understanding that a lot of pharmaceutical companies, for example, are now focusing on creating a vaccine for the coronavirus. But more broadly, how has funding been affected by this administration?
Well, thanks for asking about that. That's definitely a concern that's also shared by scientists and practitioners outside of the U.S., because there was actually this public perception study. It was a longitudinal study that was sponsored by AAAS, co-sponsored by AGU, the American Geophysical Union, and a couple of other partners, looking at the public perception of science. And what it had shown over the past recent years is that, at least in the U.S., the public perception of science is quite high. In fact, science as a whole and scientists generally enjoy among the highest levels of trust among Americans. However, during times of economic distress or economic pressure, respondents said that science funding would be the first thing that they would cut from the budget. So that's definitely a relevant and resonant and scientifically backed response to worrying and being concerned about that. And we've also been seeing that down the pipe in higher education. I know that a lot of faculty lines are themselves being stressed and being removed from having funded positions. And of course, National Science Foundation grants are one of the main components of the ways that dissertation recipients get through their fieldwork and in writing up their dissertation. And that's also under stress.
And Valerie, I'm curious, and also Dr. Rubin, I'd love to hear your thoughts as we close the segment here, but what's at stake here with the United States if we continue along this path, Valerie?
For me, I feel, and for a lot of people who share this opinion, democracy and our civic liberties are at stake. What's been going on in comment after comment, and indeed, this administration has been reckless and selfish with their powerful positions. And they put more people in harm's way that we know in advance were preventable, while proclaiming that they remain reliable and faithful to the best practices of science. And those are just patently false. It manipulates people's trust in science for sheer political rhetoric, and it puts more lives at risk than we've already lost.
Dr. Rubin, what's at stake?
Well, I'm going to confine myself to the public health question. I hope that there's a vaccine which is a miracle, and there could very well be, I'm optimistic, that gets us out of this problem. And that at some point late this year, we might know that, and next year sometime it will be available, widely available, and this epidemic will end. But this isn't the last epidemic. This is really a warning as to what's out there. We were completely unprepared, and we remain in a position where we can't make an adequate response right now. Without some changes to our thinking, fundamental changes to our thinking, we're going to get into this again, and the next epidemic could be far worse than this one. So public health is really important as a national security issue. And unless we have some changes in thinking, I think we're going to continue to be at risk.
Dr. Eric J. Rubin is the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and Valerie Aquino is a co-founder of the National March for Science and a researcher at the University of New Mexico. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks, Kenzina.
Thank you so much.
And if you work in science or medicine, we wanted to know how you were feeling about this moment. Have you felt motivated or pressured to become more political under this administration?
This is Neil from Oak Hill, Ohio. I was a paramedic for over 20 years, and then I transitioned to in-hospital work. And I did notice that I have become very more aware of the politics of the situations in the world right now. However, I don't push my politics on anyone else. I'm just much better informed, I guess.
I work in science and medicine. I work for a pharmaceutical manufacturing company. And no, I haven't felt any need to become more political under Trump because of the COVID crisis, but I'm more politically active under Trump because he is so utterly opposed to everything I believe in.
Technology and scientific breakthroughs by Americans and immigrants have made us a global leader. My political choices are for those who want our legacy and innovation to continue. This is Barbara, and I'm in Silicon Valley, San Jose, California.
My name is Joy. I'm calling from Willits, California, and you can tell by my accent, I'm not from here. I work at the bedside as a nurse. My patients ask me very frequently what brought me to California, and I have come to the point where I say to them, I'll be honest with you, it was because I had to leave the South when Trump was elected. That's what I say. I just feel so motivated to speak it right now when they ask. And when the New England Journal of Medicine came up with their article, or put their article out, their editorial on 10-8, condemning the Trump administration's pandemic response, that made it for me.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts on such an important conversation. You can always weigh in. We listen to every call, even if we don't air every one. Leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. On Monday, Judge Amy Coney Barrett was sworn in for a week of Senate hearings to consider her nomination to the Supreme Court. And in her opening statement, Barrett clarified what her approach on the bench might be.
Courts have a vital responsibility to the rule of law, which is critical to a free society. But courts are not designed to solve every problem or right every wrong in our public life.
If the 48-year-old Barrett is confirmed, she will be the sixth conservative justice on the court, and she could tilt the court's ideological balance for decades to come. And that's left Democrats scrambling to figure out how to respond. Now I'm going to bring in Mark Joseph Stern, who covers courts and the law for Slate. Mark, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So in the lead up to this week, Democrats appeared almost divided on how to handle Barrett's nomination. Have they decided on a single approach right now?
Well, they seem to have really zeroed in on the possibility that Barrett will vote to overturn the Affordable Care Act. That surprises me because, as you noted, she really poses a threat to progressive jurisprudence overall for decades to come, right? I mean, she could be on this court for many years, swatting down women's rights, LGBTQ equality, all of this stuff. But on Monday, Democrats really said, let's talk about the ACA and this big case that asks the Supreme Court to overturn the ACA. And every single senator on the Democratic side really drilled down on this possibility and said, look, this confirmation, it's being rushed, it's kind of a sham, but most importantly, it could result in the revocation of health insurance for 23 million Americans. That was their approach. They showed a lot of discipline. I guess we'll see if it works.
Now, for those of us who remember the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, those were extraordinarily, I guess the word would be dynamic, but some people would say heated. They were very emotional at times. There was some yelling at times. Are Democrats having to recalibrate their approach? And there are a couple of reasons for that. I wonder, you know, if they think the appetite that the American public has for that type of confrontation is not very high right now, given, you know, where we are as a country. But I'm not sure. What do we expect? Do we expect tensions to run as high as they did with Brett Kavanaugh.
No, absolutely not. In part because, of course, the nominee has not been accused of sexual assault, but also because Democrats don't seem to have a strong appetite for theatrics this time around. Democrats have to be really careful in how they handle this. Barrett is a seemingly, smart, capable, very charming person. All of her character witnesses have attested to how she's a lovely professor and a good friend. They want to make sure that she can't frame herself as some kind of victim or even martyr. And this is something that the Republicans have really seized on. They're trying to accuse Democrats of anti-Catholic bias, of sexism, of treating Barrett like she's a terrible human or that she's, got to be a bigot because she's a Catholic. And Democrats are really tiptoeing around that, being very careful to talk more about ideas than the actual person sitting in front of them.
And that's going to be tricky, Mark, because the actual person is the person who is going to take, potentially if she's confirmed, who's going to take this seat. And what I found interesting was how Barrett echoed a lot of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in sort of, calling her and mentioning her in a way that I think is very interesting for women in particular. Is she trying to connect with women in a specific way there, even women who might be more progressive?
Yeah, I think so. I think Barrett and the White House and Republican senators are trying to frame this as a really big moment for American women to say, look, this is a historic nomination. She's only the fifth woman who's ever sat on the Supreme Court if she's confirmed. She's someone who every woman should be proud of, even if they don't share her views. And I think to some degree, they may be succeeding with the American public. I mean, at least on day one, Barrett delivered her opening statement. She really stayed on the abstract level of, hey, look at me. I'm this, very successful woman who has a big family, who's lived a wonderful life, and now I'm going to take my career to the next level. And that's something everyone should be able to celebrate, whether they agree with me or not.
Mark, I want to talk a little bit about this idea that's come up a couple times that, to be fair, the Democrats, including Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, have really deflected on answering the question about court packing. So can you explain what that is?
Yes. So the Constitution does not actually set the number of seats on the Supreme Court. It's been 9 for about 150 years, but it has been throughout all of history as few as 6 and as many as 10 seats. Actually, Congress is the one that gets to decide how many seats there are on the Supreme Court. And if Congress wants to add seats, then it's allowed to. Pretty much everybody agrees those are their rules. So court packing simply means Congress passing a bill signed by the president that adds seats to the Supreme Court. And in this instance, as we're talking about it today, it would be an effort to dilute the influence of conservative justices like Amy Coney Barrett, if she's confirmed, by adding liberal justices who will be able to outvote her.
Now, let's be clear. I mean, the Republicans have honed in on the Supreme Court for decades now as their real strategy in terms of remaking and having more conservatives on the court. And they've been very successful in that. The President Trump has done that in lower courts in particular. So the fight for the seats in the Supreme Court has been a difficult one, particularly after the nomination of Merrick Garland and the GOP sort of stepping in to prevent that nomination from moving forward. And I give that background because it feels like there is a lot of criticism that the Democrats may want to pack the courts, if you will, but don't they have no other choice? I mean, hasn't it gotten to the point where politically this is just a really nasty fight?
Yes, that's what a lot of Democrats are concluding these days. For a long time, court packing was kind of a third rail of politics. FDR infamously tried and failed to do it in the 30s. But I think the Democratic Party is looking at it a little differently these days because the choices here are not very good for them. I mean, they can either try to expand the court, try to get their caucus together if they win big in November and add seats, or they can suffer for decades under an extremely conservative court. And let's be clear, if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, the Supreme Court will be way more conservative than it has been for decades, probably not since the early 1930s. This would be a really radical change in the makeup of the court and thus in the makeup of really America and the laws that are allowed to exist here. And so I think that a lot of Democrats are saying, look, if our only other option is having the boot of the Supreme Court stomping on our face for decades, we've got to take court expansion seriously because it's the only thing that will allow our democracy to survive.
And, you know, we're hearing from Joe Biden specifically has said, and I'm quoting here, that I've already spoken on. I'm not a fan of court packing, but I don't want to get off on that whole issue. I want to keep focused. Why is Joe Biden sort of towing the line here when it comes to the court? I mean, given everything that we just talked about.
Well, Biden says he wants to focus on the fight at hand, and I believe him. I think he really doesn't want to distract from this Barrett confirmation battle by changing the entire conversation about, you know, what he thinks of court packing, right? The goal for Democrats right now is to throw everything into the fight against Barrett, right? Leave it all on the field, leave all the blood and teeth on the floor, as Elizabeth Warren used to say, and really make it clear that they staunchly oppose this nominee, that they view the whole thing as illegitimate. But that's probably going to fail. Republicans hold the Senate. Republicans seem to have the votes. And so what I think Democrats want to do is really work up a lot of productive anger and rage among the Democratic base. And then if Barrett is confirmed, have the conversation about court expansion later, after the election, when it's less of a political hot potato, when Democrats know whether they've won or not. So I think Biden's obviously being evasive and elusive here, but he's doing it for pretty smart strategic reasons. He wants everybody to be focusing on Barrett, not the hypothetical possibility of Democrats' retaliation if Barrett is confirmed.
Mark, there's another proposal that's being batted about, and that is term limits and basically saying how many justices each president can appoint. What would that accomplish? How would that work? And how viable is that?
So the current plan is to do that through just a federal law, right? Rather than amending the Constitution, because everybody knows constitutional amendments are basically impossible. The idea here is that a justice would serve for 18 years, and then after 18 years, they would be designated a senior justice, which means that they wouldn't be serving regularly, okay? But if one of the regular justices had to recuse or suddenly died or retired, that the senior justice could fill in, okay? So there would be 9 justices all of the time, and every president would be able to appoint 2 new justices per term. But if there was a sudden vacancy or if somebody had to recuse, one of these senior justices would step in. There's a lot of questions about the constitutionality of this plan because the Constitution doesn't say anything about senior justices. This is all kind of improvisation to fill in the gaps in Article 3. And I think that there's a strong fear that if Congress tries to impose term limits before expanding the Supreme Court, that the current court would strike it down because it does not strictly comply with what the Constitution seems to set out for the Supreme Court.
Are any of these proposals, Mark, viable, or are they just a list of, you know, a wish list for progressive Democrats?
Well, what's ironic here, I think, is that the most viable option also seems to be the most radical one, right? So in addition to term limits, there's these other ideas. Pete Buttigieg has this plan where you'd have 5 Republican justices, 5 Democrats, and then they'd appoint 5 independent judges, so you'd have a 15-member court. That stuff is all really untested, untried. There's not a clear constitutional path for it. But expanding the court, that's pretty easy. Like, all Congress has to do is pass a bill and have the president sign it, and boom, you've added seats to that court. And so I think there's still a sense among a lot of Americans that that's crossing the Rubicon, that that's going way too far. But that is the one option that is absolutely on the table and that really cannot be fought in court. Once it's done, it's done. And so I think that Democrats need to absorb the loss of the Barrett confirmation, presuming it happens, and then they need to wrap their heads around the fact that as wild as it may seem and as radical as it may appear to some people, court expansion is the one option that will obviously work.
Mark Joseph Stern is a staff writer for Slate covering courts and the law. Mark, thanks so much for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban. a violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks.
This year, the United States has witnessed an uprising for racial justice, and people are demanding change in how we think and talk about this nation's history. The Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City has made a notable hire in this time. Patricia Mariquin Norby has become the first full-time curator of Native American art for the Met. And she says her role means acknowledging the reality of how some of this art came to be in the hands of museum curators to begin with.
For some community members, looking at the work of their ancestors can be very comforting and soothing, but it can also be very emotional to see items that were taken from their communities or sold from their communities during a very difficult time.
I spoke with Patricia Norby about the role of Native American art in understanding our country's history and its future, and she told me that many museums are still learning how to engage with this art.
I think it's taken a while for mainstream museums to fully grasp the understanding that we can't just present Native American and Indigenous art according strictly to aesthetics. So right now, we're at a pivotal point within mainstream museums where we're beginning to present Native and Indigenous art according to Native perspectives and also Native histories, which are equally important to the art because the art itself connects Indigenous communities to their stories of origin, to their homelands, and also to tribal sovereignty. And so museums are just now catching up to this idea that they have to take a more holistic approach. Tribal museums had already been practicing this for a very long time, presenting their art and culture according to their own histories. And mainstream museums have been doing this differently, either heavily focusing on the aesthetics or aesthetics alone, or taking a more didactic approach, kind of an Indians 101 type of exhibit. And that's what you see, for instance, with the National Museum of the American Indian.
Patricia, what type of Native art do you think has been missing? And you're answering that in some ways. I'm wondering how will that begin to show up in how you're going to be curating the collection at the Met?
Part of the overall conversation between historical and contemporary Native American Indigenous art has been missing. So we're not getting the full picture. So there's this really wonderful conversation that happens when we exhibit historical and contemporary Native art together. We get the fuller picture about a community's history or their worldviews, their ways of understanding the world. And we understand that their cultural practices have never ended. They've continued, maybe they've transformed or they've shifted and taken some turns, or there's fresh ways of expressing the origin stories of a community or a community's history. But when we take the art out of context from the communal histories, then we really miss out in appreciating how rich and how diverse Native art really is. So when I work, I'm always thinking in relation to the communities of origin. What are their perspectives? What are their principles? What are their practices? And so that's always on my mind when I'm thinking about exhibits and collections.
How should people begin to engage with Native American art if they haven't already, if they're not as familiar with it? And this is a conversation that we're seeing happening across so many of the arts and the discipline of the arts. We recently had a conversation about classical music and how it was so white. Opening up the eyes of our listeners to new faces and new types of art is an important mission for us here. So how do we begin to do that with Native American art?
Museums are not the only way to engage with Native art. So, for instance, I make it a practice to go to Native American and Indian art fairs, to visit Indian communities, visit their local museums and cultural institutions. And right now, what's interesting is that you can go online and see any number of Native artists and curators or museum institutions giving talks about American Indian Indigenous art. And it's wonderful in that you can now have access to so many voices in the Native art world through your phone or computer. This is something that's never happened before. Now I can attend a lecture given at a museum in Oklahoma and another one in California, you know, places that I wouldn't always have access to because of where I am.
Patricia, I'm wondering, in terms of talking about more contemporary Native art and artists, are there themes emerging in the art more broadly, given the political moment that we're in right now, that you're noticing? I'm thinking anything that you're seeing that that artists in that community are really beginning to grapple with.
I think that people are now more open to connecting the work to tribal sovereignty and Native sovereignty and also environmental issues. So, for instance, in my own work, when I see a pot or a painting, I not only think about the aesthetics, the cultural principles that are visually present in a work of art, I also think about how that work of art is tied to a local community, to their environmental issues. So just using a pot, for instance, from the Southwest, the clay, the slip, the imagery, for instance, all of those are connections to place. All of those represent something significant to that community. So if I'm looking at a Maria Martinez pot and there is an image of Avanu, the water serpent, then I know that that's a reference to water, to the sacredness of water in the Southwest, and also a reference to the Pueblo's proximity to the Rio Grande River in northern New Mexico. So there's lots of ways to look at art and to understand what's important to each artist's community and to their worldview.
Patricia Mariquin Norby is the first full-time curator for Native American art for the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Patricia, thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you.
Patricia Mariquin Norby was part of First People's Week here at WNYC's The Green Space last week, and you can watch what she and others shared with virtual audiences by visiting firstpeoplesweek.org. Okay, everybody, that's it for The Takeaway on this Tuesday. And if you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. It's at thetakeaway.org or iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.